when you shroud something in mystery, you distort and you leave people to erroneous conjecture. You remove the context and the frame. Okay, so that even the snippets might reach people, they reach them out of context. And this creates a host of errors that lead to more errors when it comes to information. Right? More important, it also creates deviance. It creates a power, which is a corrupting force. It creates, you got to join my group. I'm going to give you the secret to happiness, man. Send $29.95 to me. Give me a blow job. I want a good job. You know what I'm saying? What can you do for me that I'll give you these super important secrets? What are the secrets?
Yeah, those are the frauds, but by the same token, when you take something that is symbolic, it's already kind of going to be distorted because you're taking something from a pure experience and translating it to words, and you're trying to describe it with words as best as you can. And
The
way you convey it, you can't convey that completely to somebody else or to the world.
Well, I mean, that's definitely a marvelous point. I mean, just in the distortion, so there's more than one way to distort the truth. And all somehow connected with, creating a mystery, creating something that is unknown and exploiting that, making it a scarce product or resource.
Well, we have people who are very dogmatic, who are very absolutist with their interpretation, like there can only be one way to interpret something.
Well, yeah, I mean, really what can happen is I can get you to the point where you're so entirely titillated to get the secret from me that by the time I actually give it to you, you'll be convinced that it is an important truth that is unalterable and unarguable. Yeah, and that becomes an issue. Again, great leaders and manipulators and really great salesmen, are good at creating mysteries. And you guess your way around the mystery until you think you got it, and then they can come in and screw you another way.
Well, belief is going to be a very powerful thing, and it's not inherently good or evil in itself. So sometimes you can find a teacher, and they do have some knowledge to give you. And then if it turns out that they're not creating anymore, then you should leave. Then that initial belief, I mean, you take that through to the conclusion, to the reality, and the end result is that you should leave that person.
Well, I'm not so sure, Tammy, that that's really sticking with the subject here. I mean, that's more about, the leader who should be bringing new gnosis to the tribe. Here we're really talking more about the leader who exploits because they make truth a scarce resource, or they lead people to believe that truth is a scarce resource, when the truth is indeed all around us, right in front of us, outside and inside of us all the time.
Oh, I wanted to mention that last time, actually, especially with the sharing of truth. If you remember the book In Search of the Miraculous,
right.
Gurdjieff is telling Uspensky basically that he prefers to take on a small group of students to share knowledge with and study with them, because it's going to be more effective if you take a small group of people who are genuinely interested, that they could put that knowledge to good use. Whereas if you just freely give it out, then who's going to say what will happen to that, and that it could be just lost, just wasted on people?
I might say in response to that, that Gurdjieff and Crowley definitely disagree on this issue, at least Gurdjieff and Thelema, but Crowley also who coins the phrase, mystery is the enemy. Gurdjieff did things that would definitely be outside of AA stricture. For example, Gurdjieff charged his students a lot of money, which the AA you're absolutely forbidden to do. However, to Gurdjieff's credit, he spent it on his students after he took it from them. And I say to his credit very loosely, for this very important reason. While he would buy them a lavish dinner or something like that with the money he took from them, throw a big gigantic party or whatever for them, what right did he have to interfere with the way they wanted to spend the money they earned, on the one hand? So this very counter-libertarian, which a lot of old school yogis are about. And on the other hand, he's withholding information until he gets that money. You know? So, as much as I admire a lot of Gurdjieff and especially Ouspensky's book there, sometimes they're not in alignment with what's being said.
I've noticed, don't get me wrong, I appreciate that we can get music for free now on the net, but now that people can download music and make stacks of CDs just full of music, it seems to have lost its value. They don't hear the actual songs that they've downloaded. They play the sounds that the songs they've downloaded, but they don't really hear the songs that they download. It's just this vast collection that satisfies an egoic impulse to just have everything. And I see Cammy's point in that when you just hand stuff out, no matter how valuable it is, people don't really appreciate it. They don't, and they're less able to actually get the full benefit from it.
There's a great business sense in that for when trying to lead a blind audience. Okay? But the AA doesn't try to lead a blind audience, nor, and it does give away its shit freely. Okay? Because the AA won't let you join its ranks unless you can conform to at least a certain perfect level of behavior. Until you can prove you actually have an interest, desire for this knowledge. However, now, let's talk about the AA's origins, Golden Dawn. Joining the Golden Dawn, first of all, this was a club for very wealthy men in Victorian England. Okay? These wealthy men paid in dues to that club what the average person like you and I earned in a year. So, I mean, that's a high amount of dues. And there you would be training to join the Golden Dawn and to receive your first initiation. And finally, the day comes, you get your first initiation, and they give you the first big secret that you've now paid a lot of money for, and they give you the fucking Hebrew alphabet.
Mm. I mean, you know, they still do that. The Golden Dawn chapters, they still make you pay to get the Hebrew alphabet.
It's patently absurd. This is the abuse that immediately can come from, holding up a mystery. So initiations are about a formal conferring of the nature of mysteries, explaining a mystery, etc. That's part of what initiations do. Whether that's an initiator explaining something to the initiate, or whether that's life teaching us a lesson.
I could give an example of something that it seemed like a mystery, but it really wasn't. When I started to do astral projection, I read up all sorts of things, how to astrally project and, have the out-of-body experience. And I couldn't do it until I realized, screw all those texts. I already knew how to do it.
And everybody does. Everybody does it all the time. The second you sit down and think and get yourself absorbed in your thoughts, you're astrally projecting. The words themselves are misleading. and everybody's looking to leave their bodies and, you know, see if they can spy on their neighbors fucking in the living room.
Yeah, can they communicate to their friend in another state or something?
Well, I mean, it's
telepathy, maybe.
It's ridiculous. We don't leave our bodies, this whole New Age silver string thing. Our bodies are all interconnected to begin with. Maybe, like, some of the fourth wave people in that, like, distant viewing thing that they do, remote viewing,
yeah.
Maybe in remote viewing, I might connect with the node of somebody that's there. I might make a communication, but I'm not using my quote-unquote astral eyes. You know, I'm just, it's more a mental telepathy than anything else.
Well, yeah, you can't leave your body. If they could, they wouldn't wake up when I kick them.
Or at least I'd be like in one of you pretty boys' bodies over there, you know what I'm saying, looking pretty good. You know, the old little something.
But actually, theoretically, there's a way to do this according to some yoga manuscripts that I read in the library of my old university. It's when somebody is dying around the same time that you're dying, if you have like a strong enough body of light, you can attach it to the body of the other person who's dying, and when the people are resuscitating the body, your consciousness sort of dominates the other person's consciousness and takes it over. And there are stories of, like, in India, you know, of a boy who's drowning, and he's almost drowned, and they resuscitate the boy. And when he comes back, he starts practicing yoga all the time and teaching, you know, about, you know, magical secrets. And around the same day, you know, another yoga master had apparently died. And they believe, like, he took over the body of this young boy.
I gotta wonder about things, but that to me would be certainly a form of rape, so I wouldn't, we've all had that feeling where we seem to, you know, fall back into our bodies. But you know something, you know, I've sat around and, you know, like, for example, having a, I just chipped a tooth. And it felt like something really, really big when it was inside my mouth. When it came out, and I saw how actually small it was. You know, the distortions of distance, even in our bodies, leads us not to necessarily say, okay, so it feels like I'm falling back into my body, but that doesn't mean my spirit was floating around somewhere that I don't remember, because I can think of about, you know, like, a, you know, several dozen very gorgeous women I like in their bedrooms right now. And if I have to invade somebody's body, I might start with Derek Jeter. Have you seen any of his girlfriends?
No.
You know what I'm saying? He dates top models. He's, you know, like the most famous baseball player on the earth right now.
Yeah, there's a cologne named after Derek Jeter because I used to sell it for Avon.
Yeah, so I mean,
But if you're sexually frustrated, you don't need to invade somebody's body. You can just have a lucid dream.
Let me show you. Derek Jeter is not sexually frustrated. That's not his problem.
The next question is just, this initiation alter consciousness?
Let's talk about real consciousness for a minute. Does initiation cause a change in consciousness? Let me tell you a story. When I was a child, my maternal grandparents lived in my house with me. And my grandfather was my idol and my original male role model. And I was also his favorite grandson. And they made no uncertain terms about that. In seventh grade, my grandfather died. About 2 or 3 months before he died, my parents decided, knowing how close I was to my grandfather, that I should come to understand death. So a co-worker of my father's had died, and he was laid out in the funeral parlor, and my father said, come on out with me tonight. He didn't tell me where we were going. He took me inside, and I saw for the first time a dead body laid out in a coffin.
Oh.
And this in itself was, there was first an initial shock. There's the smell of all the preservatives and everything. And when I got home that night, I was a completely different person in a certain way. This naive 10-year-old boy, 11-year-old boy or something like that, now came to the first time to understand one of the most basic existential crises confronting humanity.
Yeah.
Hmm. And I wonder why parents try to shield their kids from death and knowing about sex and violence.
My initiation into death started when I was maybe 3 years old, and my dad used to give me frozen rabbits to play with.
Oh my god.
He would catch rabbits, and they'd be frozen, you know, stiff. And I would play with them, and I would be like, cute little buddy. And then, I remember watching him peeling the skin off of their bodies, you know.
You were definitely raised on the dark side of the moon.
Yeah. And I remember really well, you know, seeing them hanging by their feet, you know, and you seeing, you know, their red little body and then the skin hanging from the bottom and then just pulling it off.
Yeah.
Shit. Yeah.
So when we have an initiatory experience of any sort, some part of our naivete, some other significant part of what we see in our day-to-day existence changes permanently. You know, when I went to Boy Scout camp for the first time, two weeks, I'm like in sixth grade, you know, but it was like, in a sense, it was the year I became a man. When I left the home where I was the oldest of five kids, I came back to, it was Paul, the boys, and the girls. There were two girls, two boys, and Paul in my family. And so, you know, I had separated from childhood, in a certain sense, because of some of the ordeals I went through at Boy Scout camp. Because there were initiation rites and all kinds of things like that. And I'd already been through a couple of lower levels of that the first time I went on a camp out weekend. And, of course, you know, when you get your first badge inside of the Boy Scout, they do the whole candlelight ceremony and all that crap. It was a way, once upon a time, in making sure that manhood was conferred, shall we say, from father's generation to son's generation, if not directly from father to son, because usually the fathers were encouraged to join the scouts also. So.
Yeah, I remember we had beavers, cubs, Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts. I always figured, like, you know, Freemasons are just like Boy Scouts for men, you know.
Well, Freemasonry opens up a whole other can of worms, because here's a perfect example of a failure to initiate. The Outer Lodge in Masonic Society is the Blue Lodge. In the Blue Lodge, you're supposed to learn the very basics of spirituality, which is morality. Okay? And yet, your average Mason is truly an ignoble being, who actually eschews the higher grades outside, the higher degrees outside of the three basic degrees. He may have taken his higher degrees, but he's not interested in them. He's interested in getting to the next breakfast at his church and being at church on Sunday so he can sing his self-righteous songs to God.
I think it's become a networking system for most people.
Well, yeah, that's what it's become. And, of course, the Christian church has completely invaded it. If you study Masonry and the higher mysteries, you'll discover Masonry is anything but Christian. Indeed, it's far more Jewish than anything else.
What does that Masonic symbol mean It looks kind of like
the square and the cup.
A.
The square and the cup, the G in the middle.
Oh.
The G means God or grand geometer. The square and the compass are used to calculate geometrical positions, right?
Right.
Okay.
But it also forms the Star of David, if you look at how the square of the
compass is like a hexagram.
But the whole mystery of masonry is building Solomon's temple.
Did you find any value, though, in the Masonic teachings? Did you find any personal value in the Masonic teachings?
They denied me the upper degrees because I didn't hate Hillary Clinton all the time, bad enough.
I don't mean the political bullshit. I mean from your knowledge lectures that you started.
The initiation rituals. Blue Lodge itself, they laid out the basic cipher of masonry, but what I learned was to correlate the Blue Lodge with the first instruction of yoga, yama and niyama. Good work, good thought, good deeds. Okay? Mm-hmm. In other words, without the ethical alignment with the world in which you live, you can't continue. You're fighting the world. There's no possibility for growth. It's not being nice because you're a righteous, nice guy. The problem with morality is the way most people think of it, they think morality is about right and wrong, as if those were some absolute concepts. Okay? Morality is about functionality and efficiency. Murder is immoral is because if we were allowed to kill everybody that we got angry at, we'd all be killing each other all day long until there was no human race left. It's a matter of survival.
Look at Russia.
Huh?
Look at Russia.
Russia's a good example. If you wanna be able to own a car, you better not break the windows on other cars parked on your street. So breaking a car window is an immoral act. It's punishable by law. Because laws are based on morality. But morality is only functional. In other words, if it didn't matter whether you killed somebody or not, if we didn't find that there was anything of value to praise in keeping the human race, then the practicality of murder being immoral would be very low. There'd be no practicality in it, so let's not have, laws on the books for murder. So when you begin to understand that that's the way morals are actually formed, and that they're not about these absolute rights and wrongs, well, then you understand that much better how to align yourself with the world. Because if I'm not aligned with the world, and I'm crossing in the middle of the street, I'm going to get run over by a car. I better get over to the light in the crosswalk. I better drive on the right-hand side of the road. Because the guy coming at me, if he's driving on that same side of the road, we're going to have an auto accident, and somebody's going to get hurt.
And is that not the whole idea behind the imperative, do what thou wilt, should be the whole of the law?
Well, yes. My will is a product of this world, and it's a product of my human consciousness, the human paradigm. This is a bit epistemological. But it's the nature of being human that frames our perception of the universe.
So to tie this in a bit more directly to the topic, we could say that the failure in masonry today is the failure for it to deal with the most key aspect of spiritual initiation, which is to communicate the importance of morality and moral behavior. Individual.
Well, that's what I learned from the Blue Lodge to better understand yama and niyama.
Right.
And I also saw it in the immoral behavior of the Masons I encountered, realizing not only did they not care about these upper mysteries, but because of all their deviant little back-ass things that they do, the Blue Lodges failed to initiate. That's why Masonry is shrinking. If the Blue Lodges truly initiated, they wouldn't be getting closer to their Christian churches. They'd be leaving it, the Christian churches, to join the higher degrees of Masonry.
Well, Paul, I have a question about that. When it comes to morality being function and efficiency, as you said, and morality is a lower form of spirituality, helping people to align with the community around them.
I wouldn't say a low form, the initial form, the groundwork, the platform.
Yeah, I didn't say low form, but a lower form.
The platform. The platform on which to build the rest of the spiritual house.
Yeah, exactly. For example, when I grew up here in Sweden, from my religious background, one of my key conflicts was that of conflicting cultures. That I came into this group, and this group, and this group, and this group, and I just felt that, oh, these people have different moralities, or they have different values, and what is right? What should I do? And by this discussion, it's kind of like it's pretty okay to just change whether which group you are in at the moment, or which culture you are in order to be efficient and practical.
Well. Yes, here's a perfect example. I'm from New Jersey, okay? You want to make me feel warm, if you learn the right way to say it, saying fuck you to me would be a very nice compliment. But if you run over to, say, Kentucky or Louisiana or California or Michigan or something, and you say fuck you to them, they're going to take it as a really big insult. And there's not going to be any way to phrase it so that it's going to be nice.
You didn't mention Georgia.
Fuck you too, PJ.
Yeah, fuck you, PJ.
If only you were just a little bit prettier, Ryan.
Oh, okay.
There are differences in values to subtle degrees from culture to culture. But we can say pretty much universally on this planet, human life is valued to the point that murder becomes a crime punishable in most civilized states. So there are some values that are universal. I should say, relatively speaking, because, I'm thinking about Uganda, and the people running that state over there really don't seem to have this value for human life.
Well, if you look at any country that doesn't have a high sense of values, especially with basic things like human life and, say, property, most of those countries are not doing well. Again, let's look at all of the former Soviet Union countries. Let's look at Africa. Oh boy, it's very obvious. Their economy is shit, all of them want to get out of there and move to America or Canada or parts of Europe.
The greater the liberty, the greater the standard of living. The greater the individual liberty, the greater the standard of living. So we've come to see the value of morality. Because murder is counter-libertarian, anti-libertarian, however you want to say it. Murder robs somebody of their liberty to be in control of their own lives. Right? So, that's part of the big offense. Okay? But it is not for that reason that murder is against the law. The reason that immoral is because it would destroy the fabric of society. Obama, I'm going to go shoot him. Hey, I don't like my local representative. I'm going to go shoot him.
Well, I was discussing this with my brother-in-law. I mean, we're talking about the situation example in Israel and with its unfriendly neighbors. And he was telling me, like many of the Russian soldiers here, they don't understand why Israel doesn't just march in and kill all of the Arabs that are nearby. They don't understand it. And of course, because it wouldn't be Jewish. It's not a Jewish thing to do, you know. And then you're no longer defending a Jewish state. And then I added, yeah, and if you do it, then you'll have a country like Russia that's not safe to live in. So why even defend the country? Why not just live with your enemies then, if you're going to start lowering yourselves to such a low level? I mean, if you're willing to do absolutely anything to save your country, you could also end up destroying what that country stands for and really have no country left.
Well, of course, we see that liberty releases the human soul of humanity. It expands. Okay? So anything that's counter-libertarian is an attack against the human soul. Okay? It diminishes the human soul, and therefore it diminishes what we can do, how great our arts and sciences can be, you know, how strong our economies and our lifestyles can be, how enlightened a race we can produce.
But I would never attach the sense of feeling and meaning of liberating the soul to the name of a political movement, such as libertarianism. That might be what libertarianism aims to connect with, but it's also a mundane political movement. I would speak more abstractly, like liberty and the principles of liberty.
Be very careful, because there's two types of libertarianism. There's that libertarianism that's a part of the Libertarian Party here in the United States.
Yeah.
And then there's the intellectual libertarianism that runs out of universities that you could say was coined by William Buckley many, many moons ago. I consider myself more in the line of that intellectual libertarian than I am interested in the Libertarian Party here in the United States, which I think is, you know, just a nicer disease at first, but as if they ever got taken seriously, they'd be just as shitty as the Democrats and Republicans.
Well, I think every political party is a disease, and it's just choosing the best one. So I believe, if I have an allegiance to anything, it's ideas and principles, not political parties. And political parties are just tools that you use in a specific time to try to actualize those principles as best as possible.
Those parties create power centers. Those power centers become corrupt. The parties begin running dysfunctional political campaigns, like we're seeing all the time. And in the end, the parties become subordinate to the bureaucracy that begins to grow around, which they first built. And then you find the bureaucracy running the show.
But anyways, to keep things on target, what's the next issue in terms of our podcast discussion?
How can we
lead from this into that?
Yeah, we've been talking about this initiation, altered consciousness.
Right.
The sub-questions on that is the steps on the tree of life and the voices of experience. And after that, it's the question, is initiation equivalent to wisdom? What of glamour? What of the dark night of the soul?
If we look at what we've been talking about in terms of certain experiences changing our lives, doesn't wisdom come from experience? Wisdom is that which is gained from mistakes. Right? Show me a man who's very wise, and I'll show you a man who's fucked up a lot in his life.
I remember Mr. Bean in the latest movie. What's it called now? I can't think of the name of the movie now. But he's training on like a Shaolin monastery, and the master says to him, "You're not young anymore, but with age comes wisdom." And you see him fighting this young kung fu guy doing all of these crazy moves, and they're near like a big gong. And he notices the kung fu guy's not really paying attention, so he hides behind the gong, you know? And the kung fu guy's like, "Where did he go?" And then he hits the guy over the head with with the stick for the gong and knocks him out, you know? With age comes wisdom.
Yep. You know, knowing when to run aside and not be the young testosterone-laden creep and stand and die.
Yeah.
But also, you know, if you look back on it, you know, the kid who doesn't play with matches because mom and dad told him not to play with matches comes to know nothing about fire. The kid who burnt his hands because he played with matches against mom and dad's advice, that's the one who got wisdom. The first kid's just a fucking nerd. You know, there's just ignorance in doing what you're supposed to do. All your wisest men have not done what they were supposed to do at one point. Well, now I know I'm not supposed to play a match, and I just burnt my fucking hand. Now I have wisdom.
Now, if we connect that with the trees of, the tree of life and the Sephiroth on the tree of life, I see those more as markers or landmarks in our exploration of consciousness in the AA and in the AA initiations. So, example, each Sephiroth, such as Malkuth, Yesod, Hod, etc., they represent different levels of awareness and there are different ideas associated with each Sephiroth that we use just to organize this journey in exploring basically our potential as human beings and developing it.
I'm perfectly in agreement with you on that, Ryan. Each grade in the AA is a level of consciousness, and we each and all of us possess all 10 points on the Tree of Life.
Yeah, I wanted to
add to that. Mm-hmm. So they're there already. That we can elevate our ability to perceive beyond the gross animal being to at least the nefesh, the animal soul. Well, then we found Malkuth. You know, but learning to get, that's a big step. That's a big initiation. You know, it's looking beyond the id. It's looking beyond, you know, the pleasure principle.
Paul, didn't you write something about how you were saying that Malkuth isn't really a part of the AA or something?
No, I'm not ready.
No. Malkuth
because it's on the bottom of because it's hanging pendant.
It hangs pendant to the tree because there's a basic difference between that one Sephiroth and other Sephiroth. The Sephiroth can be all 10 Sephiroth can be divided into 4 sections. Each of those 4 sections corresponding to one part of the tree. And in that sense, we in looking at the creative the creator the non-individualized being which then evolves into life, that how do you say it? That source that. Is the looks descending, the light descending from the creative force, and it descends. We could call that light descending. We could call that the first Sefer Keter. It descends. That would become the first discernment, as the Kabbalists would call it. The second discernment then becomes Chokhmah, which is that which receives. It's the Kli, the animal body, the animal creature that has been created, receiving the light. The third discernment then, Bina, it rejects the light. Okay? A state of emptiness develops because it yearns to be the creative force. But it is really, the flesh is built to receive the light. So, Bina actually means to observe. A lot of people don't understand that. The fourth discernment then is the Zer Anpin. That's all the separate of the Ruach, Kesed Tiyasov. Okay? And here, the Kli, the animal, creature, decides to receive a portion of the light in order to create a creature and fill it with light. Okay? That is, up to that point, all the actions are done by the Creator. The fifth discernment is Malkuth. The individualized being strives to reach the equivalence of form of the Creator. Okay? This is an independent desire to do what the Creator had placed there in the first place. You know, it presupposes the thought behind the creature, not the actions of creation. The thoughts behind the Creator, not the actions of its creation. So it's that what they're suggesting is the evolutionary force rises upward, but also in that striving to be as the creator, you're the creative force. This really brings us back to new gnosis. The fact that you are a creative force, you're bringing light to other beings. So Mount Kupang's pendant, as it is, as it is the Shekinah, the reflection of the Godhead, the bride of God to be married to God.
Liber LXV says, I who am the image of an image say this.
Because the looks sits at Tiferet, the center of our being. It's the spiritual source of that non-individuated divine consciousness. Okay, and from Malkuth, Yesod is the image. Tiferet is the image of the image.
Hmm.
Or from Kether is the image, and Tiferet is the image of the image.
Wow.
Okay, depending on which way you're traveling, I think.
Hmm.
You know. So, because you have not, I think what the Hebrew Kabbalist misses is it's not just the descending looks, but there is the ascending knocks. And this does not get discussed that much, and it seems to be very little talking about, very, really greatly misunderstood, although some people in Thelema do have some catches on it.
You know, I always had a very different understanding of the knocks from what the guys were putting on the e-list in the past week. My understanding of the knocks is it's darkness, and it's what allows the light to take shape. It is the...
It's the Kli, it's the creature.
I mean, without darkness, the light cannot... refracted, and it cannot. We cannot make different shapes out of this light.
The greatest density of spiritual particles, the ether. The greatest density will admit no light. It's an ascending evolutionary force, upon which the light within which the light plants itself. as you plant a seed into the earth to grow a flower.
Again, let's take a painting, okay? A beautiful painting. Now, let's imagine we have the ability to take away all darkness out of that painting. It loses all contrast, okay? And now, let's imagine we could take that painting back to the light, under the cracked light. Well, now you have a blank sheet of paper.
Okay. Yeah, that's a good one.
So, you need the darkness, one, to refract the light, and two, to give contrast, to create details. And so, for me, the universe is just like a living work of art. It's a work of art that creates itself, and is constantly creating and recreating itself. And this light and darkness are really just two different phenomena, or phases of the phenomenon of what I would call movement, an eternal movement, which is the engine, the force of this non-stopping creation.